has responded. So looks like it's still is kind of a new mode to a lot of hands, Dick. Did you at all observe any kind of abnormality on the repeater that we got a report from out there in the island? Brendan, KC2LIM, said that it's impossible mostly to copy myself or possibly some other stations. How does this sound, the repeater, so far to you, Dick? Over.
Out here in Huntington, where I live, I was walking around my property with a handy talkie, and told you guys were clean and green the whole darn time. Heard a tiny little bit of buzzing noise in the background, 20 dB below your voice, that came on periodically. That leads me to believe that they were experiencing some form of local problem, but you were coming through clean, just as N2EO and Paul WS2N were reporting. Rich, I got a quick question for you, N2EO, and that is, how many people do you believe are on 1296 megacycles in the New York metropolitan area? 1296, I call it 1296, that's the single sideband frequency. You know what I really mean. I think it's called 1260 or 1280 when it comes to FM repeater. So how many people do you know, do you think, are on FM repeater 1.2 gigs? And to EO, KQLAW.
Okay, Dick. Well, not many. If I took a guess, I'd say maybe a dozen, or, you know, on 1288 and a few other frequencies that you use. I think it's a vicious cycle. There's no gear because there's no people, and there's no people because there's no gear. I think if we made it available, more people would get on.
That makes some sense. A pretty progressive guy I know who lives out in the hinterland, a K2CBA, Charlie Bravo Alpha, who lives in Rensselaer, New York, close to, he lives in Grafton, New York, but he's up a little bit away from Albany and Troy. He has 1.2 gig equipment in his automobile, and he tools around the country with it and picks up a number of repeaters. And I think on his property he has set up a 1.2 gig repeater. And so, as I see it, it's in the FM band, people, it is sort of the frontier. In other words, if you and I went looking for people at the next ham band above, 2.4 gigs, I think we'd find very close to zero people in almost all areas. Maybe one or two guys in the Silicon Valley area of California. Maybe one guy or two guys in the Boston area. These are two places where some fairly high-frequency research does play place on 2.4 gigs. So I think you can say 2.4 gigs is almost non-existent as a repeater. That means the few repeaters at 1.2 gigs are the frontier. Because 900 main band, 902 to 928, is recently allocated, not easily harmonically related to the other band, for a bunch of reasons, it wasn't very popular. 450, very popular by my standards. 221 to 225, I guess it is, again, not easily harmonically related. Always was a weak sister, not very much activity. Come down to 2 meters, plenty. Come down to 6 meters, quite a bit. Come down to 10 meters, a few progressive guys like WB2HWW and others. So it looks to me like number one in repeater activity is 2 meters. Number two is 450. I think number three is a tie between 1.2 gigs and 28 meg. What do you think, Rich? N2EO, K2IW.
28 megs has gotten pretty popular. Actually, 25 and 29 megs FM. I would say 1.2 is kind of tied with 220, 220 being a little more popular.
Understand. Okay, so you want to be on the frontier and you're looking for handy talkie at 1.2 gigs. Do you believe that any of them exist in the Orient and they just haven't been imported into the United States yet? Or do you think there's almost no existence? I know that K2CBA does have, I think he's on his second brand name of 1.2 gigs in his automobile with a remote front panel and whatever, and he's reasonably happy with it. But he's one of the rare ones, as I see it. So mobile rigs and base station rigs, particularly plug-in cards for the popular base station radios, there are 1.2 gig capability. But when it comes to handy talkies, I think I've heard a rumor of a handy talkie at 1.2 gig. I'm not sure if it was a piece of commercial equipment that's on an adjacent band that got converted, or if it really was a piece of ham radio equipment. So there's my double question, Rich. Handy talkie 1.2 gig, does it exist anywhere in the world as a real ham radio product, or is it only there as a commercial conversion product? And has any of this appeared in the United States? Over to you, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Well, there's a lot of stuff in Japan. It's not marketed here. Two radios made by Kenwood. One a monoband 1.2 gig handheld. Another is a 440 1.2 dual bander marketed by Kenwood. I really can't read too much. Japanese, but you know, you can see the word Kenwood and the frequency and kind of get the drift of what it is. But the stuff made by ICOM, I didn't see handhelds this night, but radios that have been discontinued in this country are still being sold in Japan, like IC1200, which is a 1200 megahertz one mobile rig still available from ICOM in Japan. The IC1275 multi-mode radio still available in Japan and a few others. Think that.
Okay, so they do exist, and it looks like a really progressive ham has to either talk somebody into shipping it in the United States, and there may be some crazy rules about that, import licensing or whatever, or maybe you've got to have a friend go to Japan, buy it for you, and then take it back in his luggage. Is there any, to your knowledge, restrictions on exporting that? In other words, if a friend goes to Japan and buys it, uses it for a week, and therefore he calls it used equipment, and then puts it in his luggage and comes home with it, is there any laws against that, particularly if he's declaring it? And if the answer to that is yes, then the next step beyond that is there a way of talking somebody in Japan, like you've been trying to do, to ship it to the United States and sell it to you, even if you're willing to pay for it in yen, so to speak? Back to you, Rich.
Okay, Dick. What was I going to say? I know I've talked to some of the dealers about bringing something in. They can't do it because it's not type FCC accepted. But I think for an individual, I really don't know, but I think for an individual to bring in any radio or two radios for personal use, either it's legal or they probably won't bother you because it's not for resale.
And as I see it, we with an amateur license are allowed to build anything with our own hands. Mel, in his basement there in Manhattan Beach, is perfectly capable of building a 1288 megacycle frequency synthesized radio. And to my knowledge, once you build it yourself, it is automatically type accepted, and with your license, you're allowed to go use it. The next step beyond that is if you take a piece of equipment that has not yet received FCC authorization as type accepted for import, but still you go to Japan, buy it, use it, happy with it, and bring it here in the United States, and let's face it, even if your rig put out a little bit of second harmonic from 1288, which is on, what, roughly 2400, I think it falls into the next ham band, I don't think that's a problem. Also, these rigs run relatively low in power, 1.2 watts. You're certainly not going to wipe out any overhead security equipment or FAA equipment or whatever. So are we worrying about something unnecessarily here when it comes to type acceptance if a friend of yours goes to Japan, buys it, and brings it home in his luggage. What's your feeling on that one, Rich? And after that, we'll pass it around, see if anyone else has got an opinion. N2EO and K2KEY, H2LIW.
Okay, Dick. I really don't know. I'm not up on the wall. I really don't know. My feeling is, though, and I'm just guessing, to bring in one or two radios for personal use, they probably wouldn't bother you, even if it's starting the war. But I don't even know if it is. So currently I have an ICOM ID1, which is a 1200 meg, 10 watt FM and TSAR radio. That radio cost over close to $1,200, and the mobile I use a used Kenwood TM531A, but I would like to find a nice compact small HD. The HD I have now is a little old and a little big. You know, you can find new stuff in this country floating around, but a lot of money for used radio because of the short supply. So I'm trying to circumvent by bringing something in from Japan that's a little more modern. Head to K2RIW, Technet Limark, and 2EO.
Go ahead, Mr. JJ.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. I'm on the board here. Rich might want to look around the used market. The Geisu SP9, the 1 watt, 1.2 monoband HD, and quite a good one. A little bit older, I guess, early 90s, mid-90s vintage. And find one used and good rate.
Very fine, Doug. Doug, you could use a little bit more audio. You're speaking quite softly, or your rig is set a little bit low in deviation. And another good suggestion. I can see how if Rich or I was dealing with somebody in Japan and trying to ship a whole pallet full of these radios into the United States, I can see how there could be all kinds of problems of legality. But onesie twosie for your own personal use, does a person really have to go there to buy it and then bring it home in his luggage? Or is there a way that you can contact a Japanese amateur, have him buy it for you and ship it to you? I'm going to pass it over to Mel and see if he's got any opinions on this. And Mel's going to drag his feet a little bit and see someone else is smart enough to tell us what's the legality of all this. K2KEY with a little delay. K2LIW.
Nothing I can only think of. This is K2KEY. The only anything that I can think of is you outlined about, you know, if you're going to bring in a number of radios, what about FCC approval or whatever. But I would assume that if the radio's accepted since production in Japan and is being used by the everyday amateur in Japan, I don't think there would be any kind of problem with the takeover.
WB2HWW with a couple of comments.
Okay, let's hope somebody knows. Go ahead, Howie.
Well, I don't know, but I can tell you that that Sony used to make a radio that was a shortwave radio. You could not take a shortwave radio into Europe that covered the aircraft band. Any of the shortwave radios did not cover the aircraft band. That's the first thing. Second, we don't need certified radio. Amateurs can use non-certified equipment. And if we can buy an amplifier that's not certified, we're allowed to operate. We're allowed to take a radio equipment and make it do what we want it to do as long as we make it work and comply with the amateur rules and regulations. So I don't know what the what the requirements there are, but I do know for a fact that we don't need certified equipment. We can take equipment and modify it and change it and do whatever we please to it.
Yeah, that goes along with everything that I know, Howie, because my understanding is that anything I build, assemble, even if I'm buying a bunch of commercial parts, putting it together as a rack and stack, I think it becomes automatically type accepted. I know that in a number of countries, a man with a ham radio license, by the time he's passed that exam, which is equivalent to the FCC exam in whatever country, quite often the guy is treated as if he has an engineering degree from a four-year college. Maybe it's a little bit excessive. They are, at times in foreign countries, treated that way. And so I think because of our track record of being very good at self-policing, very few of us have become scofflaws. Very few of us have built test equipment that is capable of jamming things and creating interference and being disruptive and so on. I think the FCC has got some pretty nice rules about ham radio. So, as such, when a Japanese ham radio operator buys a piece of equipment in Tokyo and ships it to you in White Plains, New York, I think there's no problem. I'm beginning to think where you're having trouble getting a dealer to do it, and I can see how a dealer is afraid that if he does it once, okay. If he does it three times, he's becoming an importer, and there's a whole set of new rules and whatever. But if you can find a Japanese amateur that you talk to on 20 meters, and you talk him into this arrangement, you ship him some yen ahead of time, and because we amateurs are so darn traceable, I mean, by way of the call book or whatever, we can't hide. And we talk to each other so much that if one of us, takes the check, cashes it, and keeps the money, the word spreads around real fast, and his friends are going to lean on him, if you know what I mean. So we have high visibility, and as such, 98% of the time, you can trust a ham radio operator, a guy with a real license. Very few of them are an exception to that rule, in my opinion. So contact the Japanese amateur in Tokyo. Tell him what you want him to buy. Ship him the money ahead of time. Tell him how much difficulty you're having. Blow a little smoke up his tail by telling him how much you appreciate some of the really fine engineering that goes on in Tokyo for the Southeast Asia manufacturers of this equipment, and that you want to be progressive as they are. You want to be on the front line, and therefore you want one of these pieces of equipment. I think you can talk him into it. I wonder if anyone knows anything wrong with that scenario that I just drew. KQLIW and the TechNet. I guess we don't have anyone with a comment on that subject. Right now, I'm going to, Mel has already done it, but I'm going to do it again. Is there anyone out there who wants to give us their call letters and name because they do have a question or a comment on any subject related to things of interest to ham radio operators? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, I'm not hearing anyone. Paul, maybe it's time that you give us a space report. I have heard that the space shuttle, when it took off on this last mission, some large number of pieces of foam, hopefully very small pieces of foam, did break off from the external tank. A certain number of them struck the space shuttle during the launch. I believe after it met up with the International Space Station, I think it did one of those maneuvers where everybody looked at every single surface very carefully and came to the conclusion that all the re-entry thermal protection tiles were in good shape. But I'm getting the impression that the foam breaking off from the external tank is still a lingering problem that hasn't completely been solved. What's your take on that, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, okay, Dick, I don't think it's ever going to be solved with the foam problem. And let's see. Okay, I'm getting here with my computer here. One second. YO? Okay, Dick.
YO recognized.
How copy, Dick?
Copying you very well. Mr. YO signed in, and as soon as you give your space report, we'll pick up Mr. YO. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, fine business. I think they can just control it. They've always expected something to come off of that. Any of these rockets that they launch have insulation and ice that's always been coming off. And you look at the early Apollo missions, the close-up views of all the ice coming off of that thing. It's unbelievable. Now, I heard originally, probably foam, and then I heard possibly ice. Now I heard again recently, possibly foam. So I haven't heard anything conclusive of what actually hit the orbiter. And the last I heard, they weren't going to do anything about it except take a closer look. So that's the last I heard on that. I checked the NASA site yesterday. They weren't even mentioning it. topic. And then today, on the news, the television news, we're talking about it. And the last I heard, they weren't going to do anything about it on CNN, except just take another look. But the mission's progressing. When they got into orbit, they used the 50-foot robotic arm with a 50-foot extension, and they do an inspection of the wings and the complete orbiter. In fact, Barbara Morgan, the educated astronaut, which they call her now in space, the one that has picked up the reins from the Challenger disaster with Chris Colfer, who's a teacher in space. Civilians. No more civilians are allowed in space. So Barbara Morgan in 1996 completed the astronaut training and is now a full-fledged astronaut. She's operating the robotic arm doing the inspection of the orbiter. And then the Pure Wetland, they got near International Space Station. And they use a couple of cameras, 200-millimeter and a 400-millimeter camera, zoom in right on the tiles from the International Space Station. I remember when they sent those cameras up after the Columbia disaster, they take close-up views of the tiles, complete orbiter, as they do the 360 pure west space, which they've been doing also with the Columbia mission. Eileen Collins, the astronaut from New York, the first one to do that after the first mission, after the Columbia mission. Well, every mission now they do that, they go up there to do this gigantic pirouette, and they take close-up views of the orbiter, and that's what turned up this 3x3 mark on one of the tiles on the couple of feet back from the rear wheel well of the orbiter. And we'll see where they go with that. They do have possible repairs, three different possible repair techniques, if they wanted to do that on board the orbiter, which they've been experimenting with every mission that they go up. They've taken different materials up and played around with them in space, see how they would work as repair mechanisms. So, that's the story on that. Eventually, they're going to be installing there. In fact, they're going to be installing on this flight some get-ahead work if they go into a fourth EVA to set up for another small robotic arm, which will be mounted near the Destiny module. And then when the orbiter docks with the International Space Station in the future, when this thing is finally installed, arm will be able to do what they do now when they do the pirouette. They'll be able to take pictures of it and maybe every time they pull up to the International Space Station to give it a complete overhaul. Mission itself is progressing. They've installed the S5 truss segment, which is 14 by 14 square. You know, that's the width that whole segment, that whole 300-foot long truss is all 14 by 14 feet. Well, this other piece, this basic piece, S5, is successfully installed onto the S4 truss segment. They have different S for starboard side, T for port side. You can get refer to the S3, S4, S5 piece. Well, this is the S5 piece. There'll eventually be an S6 piece brought up on a future mission, which will have another set of solar panels, another 240-foot set of solar panels, which will attach to the S5 piece that they're now putting in. But it's the space of the panels somewhat apart. That's already been installed on the port side. They'll have to eventually take the P6 segment, which is already mounted on top of the International Space Station. That's been up there since 2001. That was their temporary power supply. That thing is going to be taken off, disconnected, and eventually put on the very end of the space station. So when you look at it, you'll have, you know, two sets of panels on the port side, two sets of panels on the starboard side that will all be rotating to match the orbit of the Earth every 90 minutes to the angle properly at the sun. You know, with all of that, they'll still be missing 20, 30 minutes per day, but they'll optimize it by having things rotate on a continual basis. So power supplies are very important in space, and it's already they've already got enough power on board with the existing panels that they can, they have more than enough. So the orbiter now is installed in the Endeavour, and we set up let's call it a power jumper type of thing. When they dock, they can turn it on, and they can suck power out of the International Space Station and actually feed the orbiter. So it's a planned 11-day mission, which they have in a three-year EVA to do the work. They have, with this capability now, they throw the switch, they suck the power out of the International Space Station panels, and they can power the orbiter for an additional 3 days. So an 11-day mission turns into a 14-day mission, a three EVA mission turns into a four EVA-day mission. So they get quite a bit done on every one of the flights that go up there now. A lot of work is progressing fast. It has to be done by 2010 when they retire the shuttle system and go on to the Ares Orion / Constellation mission, which will be a blown up version of the Apollo look. But I think the shuttles will be retired, so it all has to happen before that happens. No great, not that much of a great change. The future rockets will be able to almost dock with the space station there, so fly people, men, and supplies to the space station. And that's pretty much it. The Phoenix mission's underway, on the way to Mars. All is successful. They've done this preliminary test on the Phoenix. Everything's working good, and that should arrive on the northern plains of Mars in May of next year, 2008. Dick, over to you. It's long-winded, but there you go. This is WS2X.
That's what I wanted to hear, Paul. One of the things you said earlier was a 50-foot robotic arm was used for the inspection with a 50-foot extension. Now, I'm not familiar with whether or not the 50-foot extension is already on the shuttle. Was the 50-foot extension a piece of hardware that was on the space station, Paul? How does that work? And does that become a 100-foot multi-elbow type maneuverable arm? Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, they've been doing that since the return to flight after Columbia. No, I don't think Eileen Collins had that. I'll have to think back on the first mission back. It's stowed in the cargo bay. You've got your normal 50-foot crane, Canada arm, built by Canada. And at the end of that, you normally put an astronaut, and they'll work here and work there, and different locations, but they have the ability to attach a 50-foot extension onto that with laser beams, cameras, and you know what? Who knows what else? What else on the end of that thing for all the exact instrumentation that they need to do, looking at all the parts of the orbiter. They do that when they go up. They've got 2 days to get to the International Space Station, so day one is spent doing this. They'll do it again when they leave, and they'll look at the orbiter before they land with this whole setup, this whole big long 100-foot contraption deck here. That's what they do. So There you go. Oh, by the way, there is an STS-125 mission eventually coming up. They've got a crew in place, and it is save the Hubble mission. So STS-125. Down the road a bit, but they do have a crew training for this, and that's been approved according to what I've read there on the NASA site. Took a little bit to find it, but I found it. Back to you.
Any guess as to when that one's going to fly is question number one, Paul. Second of all, when it comes to the thermal protection tiles and the recent inspection on the shuttle, I think you said there was a 3x3 thing. I'm going to assume that means 3x3 inches near the rear wheel. Do they consider that significant? And do they really have a method of repairing that in space? Back to you on those two questions, Paul.
Okay, 2009, I believe I read for STS-125, and naturally, anybody who's listening, they won't be going to the International Space Station. So that inspection arm is going to be even more important than ever. The Hubble is at a different inclination, different altitude, and everything. So that's going to be a very nerve-biting mission for the crew as much as I think the news media that watches this thing. They feel it's only safe now to go to the space station. You know, meanwhile, I can't tell you how many flights never went to the International Space Station. More flights never went to the International Space Station than this. I think they're up to 23 to the space station where they've had, almost 100 non-space station missions. So, it's 3x3. It looks like a chip on one of the tiles. I didn't hear that it was critical. In fact, NASA says that, I haven't heard a late report, but last I heard, they weren't going to do anything about it. And I heard there's three different methods of repairing it. Now, I remember reading only one for these type of tiles. I know they have three different methods of repairing things. You might be able to repair the carbon-carbon tips of the wings of the orbiter that was a big problem with Columbia. They have equipment for that. Cracks, they have some kind of a big putty-type gun and putty knives and things like that to do things with. As far as the tiles on the bottom, I really haven't heard anything conclusive that they have that capability to repair anything outside of some kind of a paste that they could put on it. I believe they have that on board. So when they say there's three methods of repairing, I question that report by the news media. I don't remember that. They might be right. I don't know. I just basically know of one. There's some kind of a paste that they could put on there. But last report I did hear from CNN, they were going to leave it alone. That was probably, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 hours ago. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. Leave it alone. And hopefully the paste, if they do try it, I guess will be an experiment. And your best guess is that chunks of foam that break off and maybe a little bit of ice mixed into it from the external tank. The external tank, as you know, is running with liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, very, very cold temperatures, so ice wants to form on there. And the longer it sits on the pad, the more ice that forms. If you're successful in taking off the first day, you fuel up the shuttle, you're in a hell of a lot better shape than when you take off the second day. When Columbia died, it was a second day launch. And these second day launches are a hell of a lot more risky, because you've got a longer period of time for ice to build up. And I guess there have been proposals from time to time to put some kind of a heater on top of the foam to try to negate the ice. Tough problem. And let's hope that the new design, which I think you said is going to be operational in, 2010, I think it was, the Ares Orion, hopefully it won't have an external tank capable of having chunks of foam to break off and strike the orbital vehicle. Now, Mr. Wayo, I think, has signed in. Give us your full call letters and name, and I think you have either a question or a comment. Go right ahead, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Stand for the shuttle, maybe a 3-year wait before the new rockets come on board, new spacecraft.
Okay, that implies like a 3-year dry spell. Mr. Wayo, go right ahead if you're still there, sir.
Yes, sir. K2YO. I was actually trying to get a comment in on the importing radios from Japan. If you want to go back to that subject for a moment, I got stuck in the intermod and then things moved on. So if you want to revisit that, let me know.
And now's as good a time as any. And by the way, is your call letters K2 Yankee Oscar or is it Yankee Lima? And if it's Yankee Lima, you know what those call letters stand for.
Negative. Kilo 2 Yankee Oscar. Anyway, I was just going to comment that the gentleman may want to try to contact the Japan Amateur Radio League. I met a number of their people in Dayton this last May. They were in town dealing with what ICOM calls B-Star. Apparently, they're the people who have been kind of pushing that, but they were extremely friendly, just very open, spoke reasonably good English, and I know that their website has an entire set of English pages. So maybe we're contacting them, and that could get you a leg in. I suspect that they are probably involved in 1.2 gig stuff as part of their D-Star. So just a thought from here.
Very fine, Bernie. Sounds like a good suggestion. And give me a couple of words. What does D-Star stand for, or what does it really mean?
D-Star is I believe that term belongs to ICOM. But basically, it's a form of digital transmission where I believe they digitize the whole message. And the idea is that I may be, say, I'm in Arizona, for example, and I know that you have a D-Star radio, and I know that you're in the New York area. If your radio is on and you are transmitting, or, you know, if you're on the network, I can literally call your call sign from Arizona. It will hit the local D-Star link, jump onto the internet, route itself through a VoLTE connection, and then pop out here on Long Island and try to hit your radio where it knows your radio is. So it's a technology similar to how cell phones work, but designed for amateur radio frequencies. It's a very neat concept. There's not a lot of D-Star nodes here on the island. I know there's one, I believe, on the Empire State Building, but probably you've got to have a special ICOM radio and specialized gear. So it's think of it as like an advanced version of IRLT.
WB2HWW.
Sounds awesome good. Howie, tell us some more about it. And are the progressive guys at 29 megs doing this or considering it?
I don't like the audio quality. D-Star, I don't know exactly what it stands for, but what it is a form of PSMK, Gauss Middleman Ship King. Is a digital mode. It digitizes your voice. It also transmits on 1.2 gig. It allows you to run 128 kilobytes of data into the internet so you can send messages through the internet and search the internet. This is mainly designed as a system with repeaters for more of the civil defense emergency preparedness. And you're going to see this up and coming in the next several years, depending on how it's going to be. The only question I have is who's going to finance all of these new repeaters? I mean, we've got a lot of analog repeaters out there in the United States. Repeaters are owned by clubs and individuals. It's going to be very interesting what the percentage is. I think there's only about 80 to 90 repeaters out there in the United States. Richie has a couple of D-Star radios. Richie has a D-Star Handy Talkie and a D-Star Dual Bander, so Richie can give you more information. I looked at the D-Star before. I was going to put up a D-Star repeater with a couple of guys, and I didn't do it for a lot of reasons. Back to you, Dick. But N2EL can give you a lot more information than I can.
Yeah, let me ask you a couple of questions, Howie. Would you consider D-Star a kind of digital equivalent of Echo Link? I mean, an Echo Link, by way of the internet, you commit to either a repeater or a proper website up north, and you can talk to your buddy out of a repeater down in Miami, we'll say. And my understanding is Echo Link is capable of doing that. the digital equivalent of that is what I think D-Star sounds like. The fact that the voice is digitized sounds like it's a kind of vocoding system, somewhat similar to cell phones. And the good news about compressing voice and making it digital is that it takes up less space and less spectrum. The bad news is that you lose some of the quality of the audio. You may not be able to recognize your mother's voice anymore. And there are people with cell phones that are doing some complaining about that. So, am I at least close on some of these guesses, Howie? Go ahead.
Yes, you are. D-Star basically is you have repeaters. You come in digitally, you go out digitally, you connect it to the Internet. Denny, the gentleman's correct. If I'm sitting here in New York and I'm on, say, W2VL repeat, I go in on W2VL repeat, and I can connect to another repeat, let's say, in San Diego or California. It's a little bit different than Echolink, but it is almost like Echolink. I heard D-Star, and I don't like the way it sounds. And I would not invest the money. I wouldn't put my money down or take my system off the air and say, okay, I'm going to put D-Star. What you got to have is somehow MetroCord or repeater coordinating groups are going to have to work out a way that if you are a group and you want to put up D-Star, they got to give you another frequency that you can use. These frequencies only take up about 6.25 kilohertz of bandwidth. I think they need to do something with error correction, but they need to get the quality up. There's another form out there, I think it's 25, ACL 25, which is the Motorola standard. The problem with the Motorola standard, you got to pay a licensing fee, and D-Star anyone can use, as long as you can do the technology and you leave it open to it. D-Star was developed by the JAL, you know, by the Japanese Amateur League. But my opinion is if they don't do something with the audio quality, I don't think a lot of hams are going to want to get into it. I want to hear a full 5 kilohertz deviated signal, 300 to 3,000 with pretty good audio. I would not spend my money on it.
From what you heard, Howie, and the audio I guess sounded metallic or distorted or whatever, would you consider it as bad or even a little bit worse than some of the worst digital cell phone systems with vocoding? Go ahead.
I would say it's a little bit worse. I didn't listen to it that long. I went out to the Suffolk Campfest, and I was doing with a bunch of guys, and we almost came within, I would say, a couple of inches of buying 20 radios and buying a repeater and just throwing it up on the roof. But when I got a chance to listen to it, and also I don't think it's blind friendly. Let me tell you what I mean by that. I don't think, and I had discussions with ICOM on the accessibility. You have to, those repeaters don't ID. Like here, you can listen. You turn across the band, you know what repeater you're listening to because the repeater will say W2VL. On here, it comes out of the display. If you want to talk to someone, you got to type in or key in the exact letters, and these radios do not have speech synthesis. So, if you can't read the display or don't have a computer hooked up to it that has a voice synthesizer like yours or one of the other screen readers, if you are a person that has a sighted problem, that particular mode of operation isn't, I don't think, complies with the Americans with Disability Act, Dick.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a number of disadvantages that are going to slow it down. My last question, if you happen to know, Howie, how long has D-Star existed? I mean, is it something that's 6 months old, or is it 3 years old? And if it's 3 years old, and people have been trying to make it popular for 3 years, and at least stateside is not, even though maybe it is somewhat used in Japan, that would suggest that other people feel as you do, that it is not sightless friendly, and it's also not very good in fidelity. And if you can't recognize the nice round tones of somebody's voice, that makes it less enjoyable to you. Thank you for any comments on that, Howie.
Well, the other problem is that ICOM is the only people are making it, and their repeaters aren't as well constructed. You know, I'd like Richie to come in here and make a couple of comments. Richie owns the equipment. Now, I would say it's been out for about 2 years. They say there's about 90 to 100 repeaters, and they say it's growing big. Now, I don't know how much of that is hype and how much of that is I kept pushing it. I do know for a fact that there's going to be a big D-Star convention or a big D-Star stuff going on down at Huntsville. It's a big, you know, it's a big ARRL. I understand that the international community is coming in. This is being, where they're buying these radios in the United States is wherever the U.S. government or local government are giving grants to people to buy this equipment for civil defense, for homeland security, for amateurs. That's where a lot of this is going in. I don't know how much of this is being bought by the typical ham or some guy, you know, like me who wants to put up a repeater. I don't know how many clubs are involved. But give it over to Rich and let Rich make a couple of comments. He owns the equipment. I do not.
Interesting. So, N2EO, how long have you owned D-Star? And how much chance have you had to use it, listen to it? And what do you think of it? N2EO, if you're there, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Well, the equipment for a couple of years, nobody in this area. You've got a repeater on the Empire State Building, K2DIJ. I put calls out, nobody can respect. I think in 2 years, I worked maybe 4 or 5 stations. K2KJI, G, in New Jersey, I put a repeater. Nobody's listening.
So from what you can tell, it is not catching on very fast. And if someone said there's 90 repeaters with this capability in the United States, either they're shoved off somewhere into Podunk, or I think you're going to tell me that you're having some trouble believing it. What do you think, Rich?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is hype. I don't know if it's going to
By the way, Dick, a lot of it is in Alabama and South Carolina. In the South, there are more repeaters. Wherever the state authorities have put some money into it.
If I buy whatever I like in a modern radio and I want D-Star capability, is that a accessory that can be added? Is it a option that I can buy? Or do I have to buy a very particular radio that is D-Star capable? That's question number one. And question number two, from your experience, Rich, does D-Star cause it to be $300 more expensive, or is it $50 more expensive? N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
All these radios also do FM, and they have to be D-Star capable, like I can. RT-800, 2m442 banders, we have some mono banders, I have the RT-1 on 3.2, I have the RT-800 on 2 and 440, I own an IC-91-88L, they're about twice as expensive as a regular FM rig.
Now, do you think they're twice as expensive as a regular FM rig is because of their newness, or is there really that much stuff in there to justify doubling the price? What do you think, Rich?
Well, I got the source code for D-Star is open architecture, but I can have a proprietary chip in their radios.
Okay, so the chip that's doing the proprietary work, an ICOM product, for the time being, I guess because the volume is low, they're charging some pretty big prices, and that's going to slow it down. That does sound like we've got a chicken and egg problem here. A guy in the metro area is going to be a little slow to buy a rig with this capability. If it doubles the price, and there's only 4 people he can talk to from the Empire State Building in a year in the New York metro area. So it's only the people who are very civil defense sensitive, like in Alabama, where it's really catching on. Interesting. It's kind of obvious that our world is becoming more and more digital. The analog type old-fashioned cell phones are rapidly disappearing. If they're not already gone, everything is becoming digital. The guys who are doing weak signal work, the weak signal JT, WSJT techniques of Joe Taylor, K2JT, are making fantastic inroads on distances and weakness of signals. I mean, a minus 28 dB signal to noise ratio, where you can get nearly 100% copy, to me is just out of sight. And I can see how he's gotten a Nobel Prize for that kind of work. So it's obvious there that the digital modulation and demodulation techniques are here to stay. Which ones are going to become popular, which ones we're going to use, that's left to be discovered. We're all using more and more microprocessor-based equipment. It's about everything we use these days. It's got at least one, if not more, micros in there to do all the fancy functions that we want. Lots of us are hooking all kinds of computer networking hardware to our radio equipment. So D-Star is a kind of digital as I hear it, and I think it's got some growing pains. And maybe it's going to go through a shakeout phase where it slowly develops into something that people are happier with, or it's going to be replaced by something slightly similar, but different enough to make everybody happier. Those are some guesses on my part. Lots of new technology at first had trouble. I mean, when you and I go to a supermarket these days, 99.99% of all the products you and I buy have a barcode on them. The barcode gets read at the checkout counter, either the automatic checkout counter or the so-called manual one, you know, like real checkout clerk. And that's how we rapidly find out the price of things. Mel and I go back to the days when everything you bought was put into a brown paper bag, and the store clerk had memorized the price of everything, would write down all the prices on the outside of the paper bag before putting your stuff in it, while the paper bag is flat on the counter. She writes down all the prices and then manually adds up all those numbers and tells you how much money you're going to give her as she's putting the stuff into the brown paper bag. Mel and I lived through those days. You guys don't believe it. You've never seen it. Well, as popular as those barcodes are, it went through a wild enthusiasm phase probably around 1980, in which people at first thought everything's going to be using it. It went through the valley of despair for a while and then climbed out very nicely. And it is now the only way to go, it seems. Well, RFID, radio frequency identification tags, are going through a similar process. And maybe D-Star is going through a process where, at least in Alabama, it started off with some wild enthusiasm. In New York City, it's going through the valley of despair. And maybe later on, when we get the bugs out of it, it'll climb back out. And so I can certainly see the advantage of Echolink-like digital, where if the message doesn't have to get through immediately, I don't have to call the person on the phone and pay the tariff for doing that, and I send a message through a D-Star-like network, and I dedicate it to my buddy who's traveling down the road in Big Sur, California, and here I am tooling around Montauk Point, Long Island, and I give him a message that it's okay if it's delivered in an hour or two, and this is a very ham radio unique way of doing it, and I can see how it can work. And there's a need for that kind of not completely immediate, but good enough with an error correcting code or with a I can't even think of the verification code that's now more popular than parity code. My mind's going blank, but you know what I'm talking about. It has that CRC, cyclic redundancy code, which says yes, the message got received correctly, or no, it did not, send it again, and so on. So your buddy traveling down the road in Big Sur, California, gets the message, and you tell him that, hey, when you come back to New York, I've got a great surprise for you. Alrighty. I'm going to pass it over to anyone who's got any further questions or comments of all of the above, if there is none. Mel's going to dig into his mailbag. He's going to choose one of the juicy ones, and quite possibly we're going to have a further discussion on what really goes on with ionospheric reflection. Because apparently we said a lot of words last week and we created some confusion according to Mel's mailbag. But let's first see if there's anyone out there with any further questions or comments. Give us a call with the name right now, K2LIW.
WB2HWW, would that be a comment and a question, Dick?
Howie. WS2N with a comment on D-Star.
Okay. Howie and Paul in that order. Anyone else? You got it, Howie.
Yes. Dick, you know, with the new 700 meg band that's going to be released for all kinds of communications, do you think it's going to be a problem? From what I understand, is the second harmonic around 750 falls into the, you know, the global positioning satellite. Are they going to have a real issue about it? Because I understand that the equipment's got to be very reliable and have a really harmonic, second harmonic being way, way down. Do you think the FCC is making a big mistake here with allocating 700 megs to be used by the general public through, let's say, all these services?
Okay, here's what I know. I'm going to say what I know. I'm going to pass it back to you for corrections on it, Howie. Right now, to my knowledge, the FCC has declared the second or third hard, absolute date, something like September of 2009, in which all analog television will cease. Over-the-air broadcast analog television is going to become obsolete. We're all going to be using digital television. And because the digital television is so efficient at giving you multiple programs on one frequency channel, they're freeing up a lot of what is currently UHF television broadcast frequencies around 700 megs. When those frequencies are freed up, it is Homeland Security, among other people, who are demanding that these frequencies be used for interoperability-capable wireless communication between the emergency services. In theory, for the first time in our history, fire and police and EMS and whatever will be able to talk to each other. Right now, my understanding is that if an ambulance pulls up to your house and sees an incident where the law enforcement is definitely required, what the ambulance operator does is he gets on his radio, calls back to his headquarters, gives them the message and the details. The person at their headquarters gets on the telephone, a wired telephone, calls up the police, sends them the message. It goes to the dispatcher at the police headquarters, who then, over the wireless system of the law enforcement people, it eventually gets to the patrolman in the field, who may be 5 feet away from the emergency, from the ambulance person. He may be 5 feet away. It's got to go through all that process. Right now, to my knowledge, there is essentially no way in which the radio equipment, the handheld radio in the hands of the law enforcement officer, cannot talk to the handy-talkie that's in the hands of any of those other services, fire, EMS, and so on. And so Homeland Security says this is intolerable. We've been complaining about this for years. These new 700 megacycle frequencies are going to be used for this. And so it's a good plan, if I understand it correctly. I think it can work. I don't know if it's going to happen soon enough, but any time it happens is better than that at all. And so let's go for it. But I can give you some examples of what's going on right now. There are a number of cell phone companies who have paid huge dollars, billions of dollars, to buy frequencies to expand their services. However, the frequencies that they bought and have paid for, and the cash is on the line and is already going over to the seller, they are not going to be able to use the frequencies they have purchased for at least a year or a year and a half, because other services are there. So other services say, I'm not going to leave this frequency until I've got some other piece of equipment capable of allowing me to talk to my fireman. So therefore, these cell phone services who have paid big money for the frequency are now paying big money to supply the equipment to, say, the fire department, to put them on the new frequencies, to try to free up the frequencies that they bought. So they're paying for it twice. Now, is any of that going to happen at 700 megs? It's a darn interesting question. So these kind of changeovers from one service to another on frequencies that have for many decades of tradition been used by a particular service, who is suddenly being ordered to abandon it, and not only is the broadcaster being ordered to abandon the frequency, but all of the people out there, the little old lady with her television set, and she's on Social Security and can't afford to buy another one, and she wants...